In our study this morning, again, we want to look at the portion of the map that is identified as the hill country of the land of Palestine. The hill country. We've talked about the coastal plain and the significance of those places, as we've talked about the plain of Philistia, the plain of Sharon, and the Phoenician plain, and the area pertaining to that. The Valley of Jezreel. When we discuss the Valley of Jezreel, we see it located very strategically between the sea and the Jordan River. We see that there were a number of battles that took place in this area. I want you to notice you can probably see these maps better in your lesson book than you can up here. We're going to fix that, I hope, in a while as we find something better. But the Valley of Jezreel, you'll see the darker areas. It represents mountainous areas throughout the plain of Jezreel. And when we think, or the Valley of Jezreel, when we think of this, we don't need necessarily to think of one deep valley going through, because there are some hills that go through this portion of the country. The western portion of this plain is drained by the Kishon River. And I want you to see that because we're going to be looking at a number of rivers as we study in this map series and the geography of this series and the significance of these rivers in the history of our study. The Valley of Jezreel. And, of course, this becomes important because we know that's where Jesus was reared, in the city of Nazareth. You recall that when comments were made regarding whether or not this is the Christ, the question was asked, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? So this was the place where Jesus grew up. Furthermore, as we look at the hill country of this area, we know that it was one of the very most important parts of the land, commercially as well as military. Now, in Judges chapter 6, I had that wrong on the map last time. I had Judges chapter 7. Judges chapter 6, we note that this was the area where Gideon faced the Midianites during the time of the Judges, when the cycle that we've discussed, being faithful to the Lord and then rebelling against the Lord, and then the oppressors who came, and then their repentance, and at this particular point, Gideon was selected to be the one that would deliver them from the hand of the Midianites. And of course, we want to perhaps add a detail to that. You recall when God instructed Gideon to do that, the Midianites were described as innumerable as far as number was concerned, and the people of Israel began to hide themselves in caves and dens and so forth, and the Midianites took away all their food. And when Gideon began to lead these people, his army was way too many. He had, God said, far too many to deliver the Midianites into thy hand, lest the people say that we've done this on our own. They vaunt themselves up or be lifted up with pride. And God said, tell everybody that's afraid to go home. And his army was then whittled down to 10,000. And then we note that God said, take them down and observe how they drink. If they drink this way, set them aside. If they drink that way, then they're a part of your army. And the army was whittled down to only 300 men. And we talked about that Wednesday night, how that they were on the hills around this valley of Jezreel with 300 men armed with pitchers, torches, and trumpets. And Gideon said, when I blow my trumpet, when I break my pitcher, you do the same thing. And he demonstrated leadership, and we might want to emphasize they demonstrated followship, because if they had not done what Gideon said, the plan would not have worked. So they worked together to accomplish this deliverance in the Valley of Jezreel. There's another reason why this area was so important. We're going to spend some time discussing, in fact, we will repeat this from time to time because it's so important, these travel routes, the way of the sea, passed through Megiddo and the valley of Jezreel. That made the control of this valley essential to the commercial trade as well as the military might of anyone who would care to control this region, north and south, east and west, around the Mediterranean Sea. They had to pass through here. Okay? Now then, as we consider further the hill country, we drop down a little bit to the middle, and this is where we left off in our last study, as we were talking about the region of Samaria. Now this area becomes quite significant to our study because of their history. Now we know that some of the peaks in Samaria reached about 3,000 feet. We're noticing Mount Gilboa, Mount Ebal. We're not going to talk a lot about those two, but we concluded our study right at the tail end talking about Mount Gerizim from John chapter 4. And we traced the history, of the Samaritans as we look back, I believe, in 2 Kings chapter 17. In 2 Kings chapter 17, you'll note in the beginning of the 17th chapter, Hoshea is reigning as king over Judah. And Shalmaneser is the king of Assyria, and he begins his onslaught of the city of Jerusalem, which was later completed by Sargon. But in the discussion of this, as we mentioned Wednesday night, one of the things that the Assyrians did was to mix people together so that there was little or no possibility of an uprising or another rebellion. And so it was when the region of the northern 10 tribes was taken captive. The Assyrians brought in heathen nations from other places and transferred those who were Israelites to other places, left some, and the intermarriage of these people resulted in the Samaritans. Now, the problem was those who were transported in claimed, "We're being eaten of the lions because we don't know the God of this new land." And so we learn that the king of Assyria said in verse 27 of 2 Kings 17, "Take one of the priests, take one of the Israelite priests, whom you brought from thence," verse 27, "and let them go and dwell there, and let them teach them the law of the God of the land." So one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear Jehovah. "Howbeit every nation made gods of their own and put them in the houses of the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in their cities wherein they dwelt." And you'll notice the various men that are represented. And in verse 32, "They feared Jehovah and made unto them from among themselves priests of the high places who sacrificed for them in the houses of the high places. They feared Jehovah and served their own gods after the manner of the nations from among whom they had been carried away." Dropping down to verse 40, it says, "Howbeit they did not hearken, but did after their former manner. So these nations feared Jehovah and served their graven images." Now, question. It was answered Wednesday night. Why were the Israelites taken captive to begin with? Why are they over there in Assyria, Randy? Idol worship. What is it that the priest had the responsibility to do among his people, along with the prophets? Or teach them against idols. But here we have the priest, and we know from Jeremiah chapter 6, the prophets also being paid. Isaiah, and we'll talk about that in the lesson this morning, in chapter 30 and verse 10, said that the desire of the people was, "Prophesy unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits." And so the priests and the prophets were doing that and telling them that it was all right to worship idols, that there would be no consequence. You can read further about that in Jeremiah chapter 23. God won't do anything. And this was the concept they had about God. Then it ought not to surprise us at all that when these are imported into the land from heathen nations and one of the priests of Israel is brought back to teach them about God, that he taught them that God is just another one of the gods, the many gods that you worship and serve, so they just added God to their list. They served him right along with the multiple gods that they previously worshiped. Now, the reason that's so important to our study, and I want you to be well aware of it, is when Jesus meets with the Samaritan woman in John chapter 4. That just rings all kinds of bells. We're well familiar with the exchange of Jesus with the Samaritan woman in John chapter 12. And he asked, or chapter 4, he asked of her a drink. And she raises the question, how is it that you, being a Samaritan, ask me of a drink because Jews have no dealings, or Samaritans have no dealings, and Jews have no dealings, I should say, with Samaritans. In other words, there is prejudice that exists between, and we just don't talk to each other. And he said, well, if you knew who it was that said that, you would ask of me water, and I'd give you water, and you would never thirst again. And so her reply again is, who do you think you are? Do you think you're greater than Jacob, verse 12, who gave us the well and drank thereof himself and his sons and his cattle? And then when Jesus talked with her about living water, she wanted some of that. And he told her to go bring your husband. She said, I have no husband. And you recall that dialogue. She said, I have no husband. Jesus said, you've correctly stated, because the fact is you've had five husbands and the man you're living with now is not your husband. And then she perceived that he is a prophet. Now look at verse 20 and 21. John 4, 20 and 21. She said, our fathers worshipped in this mountain. What mountain was that? Mount Gerizim. Our fathers worshipped in Mount Gerizim. And ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Now you see the distinction between the Samaritans and the Jews. The Samaritans claim we worship God. But we worship God in Mount Gerizim. Well, we know that Mount Gerizim was one of the high places. That is, a place where they had erected an altar to worship an idol. And they believed that God was right in there amongst them. But you say that men ought to worship in Jerusalem. Now look, if you will, particularly at verse 21. In verse 21, Jesus saith unto her, woman, believe me, the hour cometh when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall ye worship the Father. Ye worship that which ye know not. We worship that which we know, for salvation is from the Jews. Now I want to pause there and notice that in John chapter 4, first of all, Jesus teaches this woman about life. He teaches this woman that he is a prophet. He teaches this woman about worship, proper worship. He teaches this woman that you don't know God. Now wait a minute. I thought the Samaritans worshiped God. I thought the Samaritans worshiped God in Mount Gerizim. But Jesus said, ye worship that which ye know not. Now when you look back at the history of the Samaritans all the way back to 2 Kings chapter 17, their information about God came from a priest that did not know God. Is it any wonder then that for all these years the Samaritans really didn't know God? That's what Jesus said. Now the location of this is Mount Gerizim. You see why this particular place is so important on our map? Mount Gerizim. It marks a distinction between the Jews and the Samaritans, this mixed people that was brought about as a result of the invasion of Shalmaneser, the king of the Empire of Assyria, way back in 722 B.C. That's right.
Because commandment number one, you shall have no other gods before me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they weren't even offering any allegiance to that.
No. Yeah. And that's what this woman thought she was worshiping God. And Jesus said, you don't even know God. Now that's sad, isn't it? But that's on our map here in Mount Gerizim. Now, this area is called the hill country of Ephraim in the Old Testament. If you run across that term, this is the area that we're talking about. It's referred to as the area of Samaria, in the New Testament. Now, you remember when Jesus was giving instructions unto the apostles regarding what their work would be in Acts chapter 1, beginning in verse 8, I believe it is. Acts chapter 1, verse 8. Yes, he said, "But ye shall receive power when the Holy Spirit is come upon you, and ye shall be my witnesses both in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and unto the uttermost parts of the earth," or the uttermost parts of the world. Now, when you see Jerusalem, and that's difficult for me to see on this map, Jerusalem is right here, and you see the gospel then being expanded through Judea and then into Samaria. And then we note that the gospel was carried up to Antioch, where the Apostle Paul began his preaching journeys. And as we were talking last night, that's just where we know Paul went. We don't know where all of the other apostles went. But the text tells us that the gospel would begin in Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria, and then unto the uttermost parts of the earth. Now, the thing that ought to impress us about that is when you go south on these travel ways, where do you go? Down into Egypt. When you go north on these trade routes, where do you go? Up to Antioch in Syria. That's right. And so it would seem a natural course of events that the gospel would be taken along these areas. Now, I mentioned to Chris a few moments ago when I put this picture up, I think it's helpful for us to see pictures of the places that we're talking about. So we'll know a little bit about them, but you can't tell very much on this picture because of the dimness of the screen. But we're going to fix that. And we'll get that to where you can see that a little bit better. All right, the hill country, the central hill country of the land of Palestine. We've talked about a great deal of this region. The central hill country. We want to underscore not only Mount Gerizim, but particularly the city of Shechem, strategically located. And you can't see this again on your map or on this map, but look on the one in your book. You see the Way of Shur. You see this travel route? And then across the Jordan River, and it takes up this way. You see that in your lesson book? The Way of Shur. Notice that it goes right through the city of Shechem. Now, Shechem was a very important city for a number of reasons, because you had to travel through here if you were going to go east of the Jordan in this area. Now, we're going to talk about why when we talk about the Jordan Valley in just a little bit. But the city of Shechem, turn back, if you will, to Genesis chapter 12, becomes a very important place. Genesis chapter 12. In Genesis chapter 12, beginning at verse 1, "Now Jehovah said unto Abram, Get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto the land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and be thou a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and him that curseth thee will I curse, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed." We're well familiar with that, as we call that the land promise, the nation promise, and the seed promise that was made unto Abraham. But drop down to verse 4. It says, "So Abram went, as Jehovah had spoken unto him, and Lot was with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls that they had gotten in Haran, and they went forth to go into the land of Canaan. And into the land of Canaan they came. And Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem, unto the oak of Moreh. And the Canaanite was then in the land. And Jehovah appeared unto Abram and said, Unto thy seed will I give this land. And there builded he an altar unto Jehovah, who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence unto the mountain on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Ai on the east, and there builded he an altar unto Jehovah. Now we're going to talk later about the travels of Abram, or Abraham, as he's later called, and we'll see how many times he zigzagged across this particular land. But it is in Shechem that God spoke to Abram and his family that this would be the land that would be given to him. Now, back up here in Ur of Chaldee, and then in Haran, we note that God had told Abraham to get up and go. But now he's here in the land that God told him to go in, and God said, this is the land that's going to be yours. Now that makes Shechem significant on our map. It also makes it significant during the days of Joshua. In Joshua chapter 1, Joshua chapter 1, Joshua has been selected to be the military leader who will go in and lead the people in the conquering of the land. If you'll note, beginning in verse 4, God said, from the wilderness and this Lebanon, even unto the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, and unto the great sea toward the going down of the sun, shall be your border. There shall not any man be able to stand before thee all the days of thy life. As I was with Moses, so will I be with thee. I will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. Be strong and of good courage, for thou shalt cause this people to inherit the land which I swear unto their fathers, to give them. Only be strong and be very courageous. Now, as you turn the pages, you begin to read of the conquering of the land. When you come to Joshua chapter 8, Joshua chapter 8, and begin reading in verse 30. John Grigowski, would you read for this for me, please? Verse 30, down through verse 35, the end of the chapter, please. All right, thank you. In the reading of this, we know... In the reading of this, we know that Joshua built an altar in Mount Ebal. We know that regarding the memorial of this, it tells us in verse 32, toward the latter part of it, that half of them stood in front of Mount Gerizim and half of them in front of Mount Ebal. Look at the location of that. Here's Mount Ebal. Here's Mount Gerizim. Where were they? Right in this area of Shechem. Now, that makes this area a very important place, very strategically located. I also want to call your attention to this hill country and note the elevation. We've talked about how that elevation has a great deal to do with some of the events that are discussed in the Scriptures. The hill country of Judah. I don't know if you can see that clearly on this map, but it's about a 50-mile stretch of land, averaging about 2,000 feet above sea level. Now, we've talked about Jerusalem, how that it was in the neighborhood of 3,000 feet above sea level, but the area averaging about 2,000 feet. Shallow valleys, dome-like mountains over in this area, and of course Bethlehem is 3,800 feet above the Dead Sea. Now, if you're looking at sea level of Bethlehem, what would it be approximately so? Sea level of Bethlehem, 2,500 feet Very good. But in our calculation here of Bethlehem being 3,800 feet above the Dead Sea, which was only 14 miles away, what figures into the equation? The Dead Sea is below sea level. So when we come from Bethlehem down to the Dead Sea, we're looking at about 3,800 feet drop in elevation. Now, is that significant when you go only 14 miles and you have a drop of nearly 4,000 feet in elevation? That's very significant, Terry. If you were going to hike that, you would say, yeah, that's a whole lot. And indeed, so it was. Now, why is that so important? Well, if we look at Bethlehem, about 2,500 feet in elevation, and we look at the Dead Sea as low as it was, that means then there are some events that take place that stress this elevation. For example, the Mount of Olives, not all that far from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea, the land falls over 2,680 feet as we look at this material above sea level to 1,292 feet below sea level. That's just essentially from here to here, not a very long distance at all, you have this kind of a decline in elevation, less than 20 miles. The elevation dips to the lowest point on earth. Maybe that don't impress you much. But if you had to travel in that country, it would. It would impress you a great deal, yes. Yeah, about so. Yeah, about so. Now, in an automobile, that's not too bad. But suppose you had to go with a caravan or with a camel or walk it. It would be pretty steep. Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting. We've driven the road from Jerusalem to Jericho. And, you know, when you're up in Jerusalem with like you say, the rolling
Well, I've not been there, but I've seen the pictures, and it would have to be. It would have to be. Okay? Now, it's in this area where you remember when King Saul was trying to kill David. The women were chanting that David or that Saul has killed his thousands and David has killed his 10,000s, and King Saul became very jealous and sought to kill David. And it's this area where David fled from King Saul, trying to preserve his life and trying not to kill God's anointed one, King Saul. And another thing about this area, you remember when Jesus was baptized of John, and the text tells us that he was led away of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. The wilderness is generally identified as the wilderness of Judah, this area adjacent to the Dead Sea, which is this barren kind of area that you're talking about that surrounds this Jordan Valley. So this area of the hill country plummeting to the Jordan Valley becomes very significant in our study. I've put up here that it's similar to the Antelope Valley. It would probably be closer, as you pointed out, similar in relation to the San Joaquin Valley, because the Antelope Valley is about 25, thereabouts, 100 feet in elevation. But furthermore, as we consider the hill country, it drops down into an area that is known as Negev, and Richard, correct me if I'm not pronouncing that correctly, but it's a name that's usually applied to this semi-desert area between Beersheba and Kadesh Barnea, Now, when we use the term Kadesh Barnea, what happened at Kadesh Barnea? Well, say a lot of things, but one of the things very significant in the history of the people of Israel was when they came into this area, this is where they came and sent in the spies to spy out the land. Now, when we think about the land of Palestine, we generally say from Dan to Beersheba. Dan on the north, Beersheba on the south. And so we identify this desert-type area, Negev, to the south. Now, south of Hebron, the hills descend gradually into the rolling hills of the Negev, referred to as the south. Now, why that's so important is it forms a buffer zone between Canaan and the true desert of the Sinaitic Peninsula. You've got the people of Israel, you've got the Canaanites, and then you've got the Sinai Peninsula. And so that, I think, is helpful when we begin to consider some of the difficulties that the people of God had with those who were left in the land. Now, another thing that I want us to be aware of as it pertains to that text, turn back to Genesis chapter 21. Genesis chapter 21. In Genesis chapter 21, look at verse 31. 21 verse 31. Not the passage I'm looking for. Yes, it is. Verse 25 beginning. Okay. It says, "And Abraham reproved Abimelech because of the well of water, which Abimelech's servant had violently taken. And Abimelech said, I know not who hath done this thing," etc., etc. What I want you to see is that this is the place where there were wells that Abraham dug. And you can see why that would be so necessary in this semi-desert area. On the southern end of the hill country of Palestine. Now, this way of Shur, where does it go, Richard? The way of Shur. If you're exiting the land of Palestine through Negev and you follow the way of Shur, where are you going to go? Egypt. You're going to go down into Egypt. So that gives you an idea of the geography of the land. Now, that's the end of that segment of maps that I have to present to you and talk with you about, but that's not the end of the maps that I want to talk with you about. If you'll turn in your lesson book to page number 14, we have a great deal more to talk about relative to this land. Page number 14 in your lesson book. Okay, we're going to be talking about the Jordan River Valley. Now, the Jordan River Valley is of special importance, as we've just mentioned in some of the previous charts, because of the elevation factor in this area. Now, again, I think it's important for us to see just how small this country is when we begin to discuss the Jordan River Valley, which, by the way, is quite lengthy. From Dan to Beersheba, however, we've seen that it's about 150 miles. From the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan is about 30 miles, about 50 miles from Gaza, which was about 3 miles from the coast, over to the Dead Sea. Gaza to the Dead Sea is miles. Looks like I've left out a word there. Same here. Should be on the chart. The term only applies to this area west of the Jordan River. Now, there's going to be a reason for that. We're going to look at the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim, I believe, that asked for a certain portion of the land on the Transjordan side. That's another subject. We'll talk about that just a little bit later. But this is the land that we are discussing for now. The Jordan River Valley. We're going to discuss that from... Well, actually, from Mount Hermon all the way down to the Dead Sea and even south of there. But first, why do you suppose that the Jordan River itself was almost useless to the inhabitants of Palestine? Oops. We've got a lot of water. But why was it virtually useless? Well, salt, as we get down into the southern end of it, when we talk about the Dead Sea, but there were some other factors that made this one that was almost unusable. Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. It cut a trough down through. And, of course, when we consider as a bird flies from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea, how far was it? About so. Pardon me? Well, 150 miles was from the northern portion to the southern portion, but this in here, somebody want to just throw out a guess? Maybe 30, 50, well, it wouldn't be quite 50, maybe 30, 40 miles, thereabouts, perhaps. But how long did it take the Jordan River to get there in terms of miles? Pardon me? Don't think it was quite that far. You're thinking of the, well, no, you're not thinking of that either. I was thinking of the, yeah. From the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea. First of all, how far was it? Joey, you may be closer to right. I'll have to, I think I have that on one of my maps. Memory's failing me. But the river, Peggy, as you have described, doesn't make just a straight shot down through here. It meanders and meanders and meanders for quite some time. You couldn't really use it for irrigation. Why? Okay, 65 miles from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea. Okay. It's a long way. Terry? Ah. So you'd have to pump it uphill over 1,200 feet. How are you going to do that? So you couldn't use it for irrigation. And Peggy, your point is you couldn't use it really for travel. Why? Too swift, yeah. And it's too shallow, yes. Especially during certain seasons. It had fords. Linda and then Randy. Okay. I thought those figures were right, about 200 miles here. I didn't remember where the 80 started. I think this, you said, Donna, is about 65. 80 is from Mount Hermon up here to the Dead Sea. So we've added a little bit to it when we go north of the Sea of Galilee. Okay. All right. So you couldn't use it for travel. The elevation would certainly present a problem. And when you consider the Dead Sea, you can't irrigate with that, Peggy, I believe, as you mentioned, because of the mineral content, the salt in the sea. So you couldn't use it for irrigation down there. Now, the Jordan River, I'm sorry, Randy, I failed to call. Well, we're going to talk about some of these on the west side, but we've got this one, and this one that are contributaries really to the Dead Sea. This runs into the Jordan River, and these two run into the Dead Sea itself. No. No. Well, and the reason is you have over here somewhat of an arid plateau, and then just east of there, you have the Arabian Desert.
Well, as he explains here in the book, and also just as one would know from weather patterns, the weather comes off the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. And it hits the hills there that Jerusalem is on, mm-hmm. and drops all its moisture there. Mm-hmm. And it says that the weather pattern goes over the cliff, as it were, down to the Jordan Valley. It just, everything just expands. Sucks the air dry.
Yeah.
But then as it continues on up the hill on the other side of the Jordan River, then it starts to water things again because it's now starting to go higher and getting cooler and condensing. So the river would have to come down from the east, not from the west, because there is no water on the west.
That's right.
It
That's right. Yeah. And we can associate with that because of the mountains over here to our west. We know that the clouds begin to billow up and you see them come up over the mountain and we say, well, it's going to rain and we might get a drop or two. And you see why. It just, pardon me? Yeah. And that's what happens. Now, when we talk about the Jordan River Valley, the depth of this and the length and the cut of it, it's simply a crack in the earth's crust. And I have a map that I want us to look at that will help us, I think, to see that a little bit better. And as we look further at that, we see where it begins up on the northeast shores of the Mediterranean. And it extends through Palestine, Araba, the Gulf of Aqaba, the Red Sea, actually into eastern Africa. This, I don't know, Lynn, if this was what you were thinking about this great gulch, as it continues about 4,000 miles. Very long. And in understanding that, we see why it was so important as far as these trade routes were concerned. The portion from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea is called, what, Richard?
El Gor,
even to this very day. Okay? Now, here is an aerial view. And again, I wish that you could see that. But here's where it begins. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. Here's where it begins. Here's the Sea of Galilee. The Jordan River Valley. I didn't say that right. The Sea of Galilee up here, the Dead Sea, and here as it flows down into the Red Sea on eastern into Africa. Do you see that? If you have a globe, you could look at that and perhaps see that a little bit better and see this big gulch that is in the area that we're talking about. Now, the Jordan River Valley. We wouldn't think that this is so small. It's about 2 to 15 miles wide. Now, we looked up here, we said that this area was, what, about 30 miles wide? About 50 miles wide down here? So when we look at the Jordan River Valley, it's only about 2 to 15 miles wide on either side. Well, cliffs on either side. I understand that, and Richard, you pointed this out because you've traveled there, that there is tropical areas down in the valley. Now, that brings our attention to 1 Kings chapter 13. In 1 Kings chapter 13, you read of a young prophet. The young prophet was instructed to cry out against the idols that King Jeroboam had set up, one in Dan and one in Bethel. That's in 1 Kings chapter 13, beginning in verse 23. We'll talk about that, but the previous portions tell us of the young prophet crying out against the altar that was in Bethel that King Jeroboam had set up. Now, King Jeroboam invited the young prophet to come and to dine with him. And how did the young prophet respond? Can't do that. God told me not to do that. But then there was an old prophet that sent his son and invited this young man to come and dine with him. And the young man said, no, can't do that. He correctly answered. But the old prophet said, I too am a prophet, and God has told me that you could. So the young man went, and he dined with the old prophet, and then on his way home, what happened to him? He got it. He was eaten up by lions. And what that tells us is that there were lions in this area. Lions in the Jordan River Valley, in somewhat of a tropical area. Okay? As Richard described it, lush. Now, how does this all start? I would like to visit this area and see this for myself. But I understand Mount Hermon up here to the north is a huge mountain going up to about 10,000 feet in elevation, much of which is porous rock. And then when the waters, the snow, begins to melt, what happens to the water? It begins to be absorbed by the rock. Considering the elevation, it comes out somewhere and creates huge springs. In fact, I understand one of the largest springs in the world that forms the Jordan River. The Jordan River then flows into Lake Hula. Lake Hula doesn't exist today. It's been drained and has become some very productive farm country. So if you look for Lake Hula on the map, you won't find that today. It's a place that existed in Bible lands. But Lake Hula then flowed into the Sea of Galilee. The river drops 900 feet, 80 feet per mile, most of which of that is in an 8-mile stretch. Now, Peggy, what does that tell us about the Jordan River? It's swift. This is some really swift water, which makes it really unusable. It descends another 600 feet in 65 miles to reach the Dead Sea. Now, that's what number I was looking for, Joey, and you were closer than I was from the Sea of Galilee down into the Dead Sea. Donnie, you were right on. Yes. Yes. That's right. That's where the Yarmouth here joins it, and then you've got the Jabbok River, I believe, that flows into it just a little bit further south. So you've got considerable amount of water going into this area. Now, when you're studying about the Sea of Galilee, sometimes a particular body of water or a particular man or a particular city is called by several names in the Scriptures. And when we read that, sometimes that just gets us confused. Unless we examine the context, examine the passages, and see what terms are used and how they're used. The Sea of Chinnereth is used in a number of texts, for example, in Joshua chapter 13 in the Old Testament to describe the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is used a number of times in the New Testament, also called in the same verse, the Sea of Tiberias. It's also referred to in Luke chapter 5 and verse 1 as the Lake of Gennesaret. Now, when you find these terms, you're not talking about different bodies of water. You're talking about this one, the Sea of Galilee. All right, now I hope those things are helpful to us as we label those and get an understanding of them. As we prepare ourselves for the biblical study of the events that take place in these areas. All right.